Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, we visit a quake-devastated village in Nepal. A sharp international response to Indonesian executions of foreigners. CARE reaches out to Muslim youth to be leaders in their communities.
It's important for the community to become mobilized and engage in the political process as part of the American way.
And a new report says worldwide conditions for media have fallen sharply. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Search and rescue workers continue picking through rubble caused by the magnitude 7.8 earthquake in Nepal Saturday. Officials said today the official death toll had climbed past 5,000 people, with another 10,000 injured. Help has been slow to reach remote areas of the nation, with poor roads and rain making travel by land a major challenge. Correspondent Steve Herman has reached the village of Sangku, east of the capital, Kathmandu.
Here in Sangku, it is a scene of quite substantial devastation. It appears that more than 80% of the houses and other buildings were destroyed by the earthquake. But this is really a story here about survival, a combination of luck and timing, the timing being that most of the adults around here were out working in the fields when the earthquake hit, and the children were playing outside. That said, the locals tell us that before any of the rescuers showed up today, that they had retrieved about 70 bodies from in the rubble. The total population of the area is about 10,000 people. And today is the first time that any of these foreign rescue teams with their sophisticated equipment have reached here. The Nepal Army got in here a couple of days ago, and it is really now a story of cooperation and a race against time. Among the foreign rescuers is a group from Guizhou province in China, and they stress that the government did not send them here from China, this group called Blue Sky Rescue, that they paid their own way here, and they're self-organized. And they are in a quite a hazardous place where a number of buildings have collapsed and others are still standing, parts of them standing precipitously. And an aftershock that could come at any time could bring this rubble down on these Chinese rescuers. And also in this community, there are a small number of French and Singaporean search teams that are looking for bodies. And we asked one of the members of the Chinese rescue team whether he had any hope of finding anyone alive. He said he was still hopeful, although he acknowledged that with this amount of time since the quake, that it would be quite rare to still find anyone alive.
How are the residents doing? Are they appreciative of these efforts being made on their behalf?
Well, obviously, they wanted help to arrive sooner. The earthquake happened on Saturday. And we put this question to a police armed forces colonel, and he said he definitely empathized with the frustration being expressed by the locals that they had not seen anybody from the government, and they hadn't gotten any food and aid earlier, but he said that Nepal's government, with its very limited resources in the best of times, was doing its utmost to help the people here. People are getting food and water now here in Sangku. We ran into a group of Sikhs from New Delhi, the capital of India, who have brought in supplies and are setting up a relief center in front of a school where families are setting up makeshift shelters inside the school. And so things are starting to look up, but people are very concerned about the long term, and they want to get back inside the rubble of their homes because they want to try to retrieve their precious grain, and they are worried that without that grain that they will starve because there may be some scant aid coming in for the short period of time, but they know they're going to have to fend for themselves in the long term.
VOA correspondent Steve Herman in the village of Sanku, east of the capital, Kathmandu. The UN estimates the earthquake has affected 8 million people, more than a quarter of Nepal's population, with 1.4 million people in need of food. UN Humanitarian Chief Valerie Amos is due to travel to Nepal on Thursday to assess aid operations. Indonesia has defended its execution of 7 foreigners and 1 national convicted on drug trafficking crimes as part of a war against horrible drug crimes that threaten the nation's survival. The 8, including 2 Australians, 4 Nigerians, and a Brazilian, were put to death by firing squad shortly after midnight today. They refused blindfolds and reportedly sang as they were led to a forest clearing near their prison. The executions have drawn a sharp international response from rights groups and world leaders. Australia recalled its ambassador to Jakarta, and Prime Minister Tony Abbott today denounced the action as cruel and unnecessary.
Cruel because both Andrew Chan and Myron Sukumaran spend some decade in jail before being executed, and unnecessary because both of these young Australians were fully rehabilitated while in prison. Australia respects the Indonesian system. We respect Indonesia's sovereignty. But we do deplore what's been done, and this cannot be simply business as usual. For that reason, once all the courtesies have been extended to the Chan and Sukumaran families, our ambassador will be withdrawn for consultations. I want to stress that this is a very important relationship between Australia and Indonesia, but it has suffered as a result of what's been done over the last few hours.
Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff said in a statement that the execution of a 2nd Brazilian citizen in Indonesia this year marks a serious event in the relations between the two countries. Indonesian expert Peter McCauley of the Australian National University tells VOA's Victor Beattie there is no question Indonesia has a serious internal drug problem.
And what is also important politically in the current situation is that there is a strong support, strong domestic support from voters, from the community, for the government to take firm action against the drug smugglers. In other words, there is very, very little sympathy at all, almost zero sympathy for people who trade in drugs. And this then extends to views about the death penalty. I noticed a poll in one of the leading newspapers in Indonesia. It's called Kompas, very well-respected newspaper in Indonesia, took a poll and found that there was something of the order of 86% of the respondents were in favor of the death penalty for drug smugglers.
Do you anticipate that the young administration of President Joko Widodo will have its first crisis on its hand with these executions?
It's a difficult situation. Domestically, it's not a crisis. Domestically, it will bolster President Joko Widodo. Domestically, it will be seen as proof of the fact that he is prepared to take tough action. However, internationally, it looks as if it will be a problem. There is a strong international reaction to the death penalty, particularly in Western countries. We need to note that. This is a problem more in Western countries, in the rich world, rather than in developing countries. So it will be embarrassing. It will cause some difficulties. But for the time being, I expect that Jokowi will tough it out. He might change his mind later, but for the time being, he will tough it out.
Earlier today, Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott announced that his country was withdrawing its ambassador from Jakarta in response to the executions, which included 2 Australians. He said the executions are both cruel and unnecessary.
Yes, that's true. Well, this is not unexpected that the Australian government would withdraw their ambassador, because there were earlier executions a month or so ago which included nationals from the Netherlands and from Brazil. And at that time, both the Netherlands and Brazil withdrew their ambassadors. So I think that Joko Widodo, the president of Indonesia, and the Indonesian Foreign Affairs Service would already have expected the withdrawal of the Australian ambassador. In a sense, they have already allowed for this. They have factored it into their decision, and they have decided that the Australians can go ahead and do that. And indeed, there is now, I notice, commentary, speculation in the Australian press that Indonesia itself will retaliate by withdrawing their own ambassador from Australia. So it's quite possible that there will be Indonesian retaliations to Australian action.
It's interesting that these executions come at a time where here in the U.S. there's a real push to decriminalize some drug offenses that have sent people to prison.
There is simply, in this particular case, a very wide divergence between public opinion in countries such as America and Australia on one hand, and public opinion within Indonesia on the other. There's just a different view, and there's wide support within Indonesia, as I've said, for the drug penalty. There is virtually no support at all for decriminalization. So it's just that the different countries have strongly different views, and the governments in each country are reflecting, of course, not surprisingly, the governments are reflecting what their own communities think.
McCrawley says at least 40 people are on death row in Indonesia, and more executions are possible, and that President Widodo has indicated he plans to proceed with all the executions in batches. McCrawley says the most recent executions represented batch number 2. Filipino Mary Jane Veloso, accused of smuggling drugs into Indonesia in 2010, was granted a last-minute stay of execution pending further investigation into her case.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE, is trying to help Muslim youth become leaders in their communities and proactively take a stand against hate towards Muslims. They recently held a Muslim Youth Leadership Symposium in the Maryland State Capitol. Zainab Chowdhury is the Maryland Outreach Manager for CARE, and we asked what her organization hopes to accomplish.
So the goal of the Muslim Youth Leadership Symposium, or MILS, is really to expose Muslim youth to the political process, to educate them more about what happens, for example, in the Maryland state capital of Annapolis, and allow them an opportunity to meet with state legislators, learn more about the Maryland General Assembly, and how bills are introduced and passed into law, with the hope that this will spark their interest and encourage them to become more politically and civically engaged.
And how will this help them?
The issues that are voted on and legislation that is introduced or passed in Annapolis every year during the Maryland General Assembly session, it impacts all communities, regardless of religion or ethnicity or background or what have you. And the American Muslim community in Maryland is no different. We're impacted on different levels by legislation that's introduced, and the communities have a vested interest in making sure that their voices are heard. If they're not speaking for themselves, then they're allowing others to speak for them, and they may not necessarily represent the views that that are in their own best interest. So it's important for the community to become mobilized and engage in the political process as part of the American way. Is something that our Constitution encourages, and our hope is that with the symposium, it will open a door. Many of the youth who attended, actually most of the youth who attended, had never even been to Annapolis. They had no idea where the state capitol was located. So it really was an exciting time and an opportunity for them to connect more with state-level legislators and learn more about what their potential role could be in helping to create a society that really really reflects the needs of their communities.
In helping these young people become leaders, what are some of the specific steps that you are taking?
So it's a multi-pronged process. Part of it is not only educating the youth on their roles and responsibilities and avenues where they can make an impact, but also providing the tools and the resources and the training for them to enact this knowledge and put it into practice and really see some tangible results. And so we do this through multiple means. We not only hold or organize events like the symposium, but we also encourage folks to volunteer, whether it's for political campaigns where they would go door knocking on doors, encouraging people to vote, or get out the vote drives, holding get out the vote drives, or many different initiatives that we encourage the youth to become more politically engaged. And the goal of this is to really enable them to exercise their constitutional rights, participate in the political process, which is part of our part of the American way of life, and really take advantage of the opportunity to raise their voices and make them be heard.
Unfortunately, due to the terrorism we've seen in recent years, hate crimes and hate against the Muslim community has worsened. Do you think this course, these steps for these young people might help curb that hatred?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've definitely seen a spike in anti-Muslim sentiment in the United States recently, only this year, with the tragic shootings in North Carolina, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and numerous incidents where houses of worship have been attacked, or Muslims have been targeted, or people who appear to be Muslims have been targeted in hate crimes and bias attacks. We've definitely seen a tremendous or significant spike in backlash against the Muslim community. And so the part of the goal is also to encourage our community to rally around legislation that protects them from racial and religious profiling, and that really allows a safe space for all of us to be Americans in our individual capacity without being fearful that we would be targeted because of our faith and our ethnicity.
Zainab Chowdhury, Maryland Outreach Manager for CARE, speaking with us from Baltimore. A new report says worldwide working conditions for the news media have fallen sharply to their lowest point in more than 10 years. The study says journalists are facing more restrictions from governments, militants, criminals, and owners of the media. Correspondent Meredith Buell has details for VOA Television.
You can buy a newspaper nearly everywhere, or check out the latest headlines on your smartphone. And while the news may be easy to access, journalists are finding themselves in courtrooms, behind bars, intimidated, even silenced, according to a report by the independent watchdog organization Freedom House. Vice President for Analysis, Vanessa Tucker.
Unfortunately, the news is very bad. Press freedom suffered a global decline in 2014. It's the worst decline in a decade. Things are getting bad, and they're getting bad even faster than they have in the past.
According to Freedom of the Press 2015, Mexico intimidated journalists and passed a controversial communications law. While much of North America was rated as having a free press, much of Latin America was either partially free or not free. And the United States was criticized for the rough treatment of journalists by police during protests in Ferguson, Missouri. In the Asia-Pacific region, only 5% of the population had access to free media, while the rest were split evenly between partly free or not free. China's score was the worst since the 1990s, as authorities jailed journalists and tightened control over media outlets.
One of the areas that we noted that's a real problem globally and regionally right now is the impact of actors like China on their neighbors. So we saw that actions that China took had a negative impact, of course, in Hong Kong, in Taiwan, and some of the other neighboring countries.
In Syria, the brutal civil war created grave dangers for journalists. The report says just 2% of people in the Middle East and North Africa live in free media environments, while the vast majority live in countries labeled not free. In sub-Saharan Africa, only 3% of the population is exposed to information from free media. More than half of the press is partly free, and nearly 40% are not free. The Freedom House report says the Eurasia region's average score remained the worst in the world. More than 80% of the media was judged as not free, and less than 20% partly free. In Russia, the report says there was a crackdown on independent voices inside the country and in neighboring nations.
One of the big areas of troubling impact that we saw was in propaganda. So completely fabricated propaganda such that people inside of Russia have essentially no idea what's going on in conflicts like that in Ukraine.
Freedom House says the growing threats to the media are a stark challenge to democratic values around the globe. Meredith Buell, VOA News, Washington.
Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe will receive the rare honor of addressing a joint meeting of the U.S. Congress today as he continues his week-long trip to the United States. He will become the first Japanese Prime Minister ever to address a session of both houses of Congress. Tuesday, President Obama welcomed the Japanese leader to the White House in a pomp-filled ceremony. In his greeting, Mr. Obama said, quote, "The United States has renewed our leadership in the Asia-Pacific. Prime Minister Abe is leading Japan to a new role on the world stage. The foundation of both efforts is a strong U.S.-Japan alliance," end quote. Mr. Abe described the U.S.-Japanese alliance as more robust than ever and said Tokyo would be at the forefront with the U.S. in confronting global challenges. Before the remarks, the two leaders reviewed U.S. troops and then shook hands with many of hundreds of people gathered for the ceremony. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The other shoe is now dropped in Burundi, where supporters of President Pierre Nkurunziza have disregarded the Arusha Agreement's provision on presidential term limits and nominated him for re-election. The agreement, the peace deal that ended Burundi's long civil war, has been the basis of the country's peace and stability for the past decade. Protests in the capital, Bujumbura, flared into violence after the ruling National Council for the Defense of Democracy, Forces for the Defense of Democracy Party, chose Nkurunziza as their presidential candidate for the June 26 balloting. Police and protesters clashed around the city, and authorities used water cannon, tear gas, and small arms fire to break up the crowds. At least two demonstrators were confirmed killed, others injured, and about 200 arrested, including several prominent civil society and human rights leaders. The government shut down all independent radio stations. Over 20,000 Burundians have fled to neighboring Rwanda, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Tanzania in recent weeks to escape intimidation and violence. The United States deeply regrets the CNDD-FDD's choice to ignore the term limit provisions of the Arusha Agreement and renominate President Nkurunziza. With this decision, Burundi is losing an historic opportunity to strengthen its democracy by establishing a tradition of peaceful, democratic transition. The United States calls on all parties in Burundi to avoid actions such as hate speech that could provoke further violence. We continue to support the Burundian people's peaceful pursuit of their democratic rights and freedoms. We regret the significant missed opportunity, but the hard work of building democratic practices and institutions must continue. In that spirit, we urge all parties to participate in the legislative and national elections and ensure these electoral processes are inclusive, transparent, credible, free, and conducted in an environment without intimidation or violence. We specifically call on the Burundian government to respect the rights of all peaceful political parties and their candidates to campaign, hold meetings and rallies, and express their views. We also call on the Burundian government to respect the right of the media to report freely on the electoral process and campaigns. All parties must abide by the nonviolence charter signed March 9th and refrain from any violent acts, including hate speech or other provocations, that could feed the climate of fear and instability. We commend the neighboring countries for their efforts to receive the over 20,000 Burundians who have fled the country and encourage their continued coordination with UNHCR to provide asylum to those fleeing political violence. The United States will continue to monitor the situation in Burundi closely and take targeted measures to hold accountable those individuals who participate in, plan, or order violence against the civilian population. Violence has no place in democratic elections.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.